saying it's either this way or this way. You can be the friend of God, you can be the friend of the world, you can't have a foot in both places. You have to make a choice. And if you don't make a choice, a default choice is going to be made. That's clear, I think, to a lot of people. But what may not be as clear, or perhaps where we stumble a little bit, is trying to sometimes make a distinction between if we are involved with this activity, are we really part of the world, or are we still a faithful Christian? Let me give you one illustration, then I'll let you see if you can offer some others. Here's the fella, you know, he could work 40 hours, and his job would let him work 40 hours, and he can make sufficient money for his family on 40 hours a week. But he has the opportunity to work 80 hours a week. He has the opportunity to go from 5 days a week to 7 days a week. And that 7 day a week period means Sunday is completely off limits as far as worship. And he decides he's going to work those 80 hours and pick up all the extra overtime. Now, would you say that that guy is immoral? All right. At least not in the sense that we normally think of immorality. When we're thinking about immorality, what comes to mind? Well, okay, there's some kind of sexual sin, or the guy is... All right, there's false worship. He's maybe a liar, maybe stealing from the plant, whatever it might be. So we don't really associate immorality with that. But would you say that he's really living the life after the Spirit?
No.
All right. Why not? Well, Stan, we'll start with you.
Well, there's two answers to that, I think. If the man is working the extra 40 hours because his two-year-old car doesn't satisfy him and he wants a brand new car, then I would question it. If he's working that 80 hours a week because he has, over the past 10 or 15 years, supported a children's home somewhere.
Sure.
And he knows that they could use that money, and he works to achieve that, and sends that money to them, then I would not call him that.
Correct, correct. But I'm trying to narrow my example so we exclude your second part of the illustration. In other words, I'm trying to say that there's no noble purpose for the extra 40 hours. So let's just go ahead and be a little more specific on that point. Here's a fella. 40 hours would let him support the children's home and all the other stuff. He's got a really good job. He picks up the extra 40 because he wants the best of the best and this, that, and the other thing. So, again, we come back to this question. Ray, I saw your hand, and Gary, I saw your hand, and maybe another one, or maybe Tim was in there too. But my question is, when Paul talks about the mind of the flesh, would we go so far as to say that this guy who is seeking these extra 40 hours, maybe even goes to the boss and says, I want the extra 40 hours, would we say that he is seeking the mind of the flesh? Gary, to you first.
He's not putting God first in a position that he can't. He has the option to put God first easily, but he chooses to put fleshly things first, money. And so that is important.
Let's say that you were an elder, Gary. We're just going to bump you forward several years in time. You're in an elders meeting. The question comes up, should we withdraw from this brother? Assuming we talk to him. I mean, not just, well, let's drop the hammer on him. But I'll just put you on the spot. Let's talk to him. And if he still says, hey, I really like the money. And, you know, I know I could be there Sunday, but I really like the income I have. He refuses to change his ways. Would you withdraw from him?
I guess it would depend on how long it's been going on. You always want to give them an opportunity to turn themselves around and to see their ways.
George, I've got a hand ahead of you, so Ray, we'll take your hand.
Years ago, we had two or three people that worked at the baseball games on a Sunday, and at Sunday morning, they wouldn't be there. And like I said, there's two or three, but they kind of encourage others to follow them down there to work in the concession stands, okay? And at one time, we had 11 or 12 people that was missing Sunday mornings, and it was a group the size of what we have here. And I don't know that the elders ever said anything about that to them, but it sure upset me to see that.
Yeah,
because it was just extra money. You could do this. You could go whatever, you'll have extra money. None of them needed that, just like
yeah. And see, that's the point that I'm trying to bring out. If it were, as Betty said, fornication, or the guy is stealing from the company, for us, that is so clear cut, we say that's the mind of the flesh. But I want us to expand our thinking a little bit and see that the mind of the flesh, it would seem to go beyond what we normally would attach it to. All right, George, to you.
Yeah, so two things. One, we're using this term immoral, but the words that we, the ideas and actions that we easily associate that word with.
Flesh is what you mean. Or
yeah,
immorality.
But not so broadly, because you're right, what this guy's doing is choosing the flesh over God. And yet we have a hard time calling it immoral.
We do.
Why? Because our definition of morality is defined by our society.
Correct.
Given that morality is the study of the mores, the practices, what is acceptable in a given society. So I'd rather talk about ethics, what he ought to do, and why he ought to do it, rather than morals. Since morals are derived from ethics, let's go right to the top and turn the head rather than dealing with the body. But the other is, if he's consistently choosing to absent himself from the assembly, It would be ridiculously pointless to disfellowship ourselves from him when he's already disfellowshipped himself from us. I've seen churches do that. The elders will get up and make a pronouncement. Well, so-and-so hasn't been attending for 3 years, so we're withdrawing fellowship.
Yeah.
You're withdrawing what?
Yeah.
There is no fellowship.
Correct. Yeah. And you would have to, I think, go back to the point that Gary made, and it was a very good point. I shouldn't have put you on the spot like I did, but... It was helpful, I think, to initiate the discussion. But here's a fellow who makes a decision. It looks like it's going to last for a while. You talk to him, and he says, I like the money. I'm going to continue on. But yes, if that's something we're in the kind of situation that Ray described, maybe that's been going on for, you know, 3 or 4 years, and then you haven't dealt with it, then you're really not doing anything other than just trying to kind of dot the I's and cross the T's and deal with the technicalities there. Well, let's see. We have about 4 hands here. I'm going to have to keep them in order. Betty, we'll go to you first.
If you put disfellowship someone to that, like George said, they've already disfellowshipped themselves from the group. And if we come along and say, well, okay, we're going to disfellowship you, 10 years down the road, this guy may decide, hey, I've been wrong all these years. I need to go back to God. Now, But they've just fellowshipped me, and they won't accept me back. So if he's voluntarily disfellowshipped himself, he might voluntarily come back. Where if the church group then, after he's disfellowshipped himself for a few years, comes in and says, we're going to disfellowship from you, that may deter him from ever coming back.
That's true. Disfellowship is a difficult thing to do. And that's why, at least in my estimation, the Bible pictures that as being the last step in a multi-step process. There are times, obviously, 1 Corinthians 5 is certainly a case where you do read about that. Paul, 2 Thessalonians chapter 3, withdraw from the disorderly. Those things are taught. But a lot of times, people, again, going back to what George was saying, we want to disfellowship them and just kind of sign on the dotted line, where it's not a technicality kind of thing, but that's unfortunate that some have come to that conclusion. Stan, you can just keep your hand down for a minute. There are a couple ahead of you.
I'd like to answer
okay.
Betty's comment. Whenever a disfellowshipping takes place, the hard part for the eldership is to know when, to be able to decide, okay, what we're seeing here is not something that we think we can correct. We're not going to be able to. Sometimes that leads to the fact that it's a while before it actually happens. The fact that they left and then voluntarily came back, that is a possibility. But the fact that they've been disfellowshipped should not affect that, because they can still come back.
Correct. Yeah.
So
you're right. It's very easy for people to let a situation go. Parents, you can take it outside the church. Parents let a situation go, and then finally they go see the counselor after the child is, you know, I remember many years ago here, someone came to me. They had failed to be the kind of parent that they should have been for a number of years. The child was like 16, 17, and it was, well, we're going to bring him to the preacher and have the preacher fix him. Well, you know, it's not a little late, it's a lot late. In fact, it's too late. You know, you fouled up years and years of poor parenting, and now you're expecting some. I mean, it would be like going to a professional counselor and saying, or you go to the doctor and say, I have ruined my body part over a period of 60 years. I've abused it and never got treatment for it, and it's been ruptured and torn and every other possible thing, and, you know, fix it in 20 minutes. You know, they would just say it's just not possible. All right, Don, to you. I thought you raised a hand.
I did.
Okay.
Okay, you said this guy elected to go every Sunday, he'd be working.
Yes.
The money.
Yes.
Then at what level would you case a guy, a woman, that is seeking a job? Is this job required every one Sunday a month you have to work? So
well,
three Sundays a month, you could attend services, but one Sunday you couldn't. Will you put that person on?
My question would be, I guess you could ask this as a question and then illustrate it. Did Jesus believe in doctors? Did Jesus believe in doctors?
Yes.
He did. And we know that. I made that point, I think, in a sermon or a class a couple weeks back. He said, they that are whole have no need of a physician, but they that are sick. So Jesus recognized the value and the importance of medical doctors. So you might say if there is an authorized occupation in the Bible, being a medical provider is one example of that. Now, in our culture, if you want to be a medical provider, and again, I've never taken any doctor training, but the doctors that I know of, as far as the residency programs, they're required to work some weekends. Well, the weekend is going to involve Sunday. Generally, when you look at the residents, they work some very long hours in the ER. Maybe Marcia can comment on this, but at least that's my understanding. And the chance that you're going to be able to meet with a local congregation on Sunday is probably slim to none. So there you have, on the one hand, doctors are authorized. On the other hand, you have, in our culture, doctors being put in a position where they're going to be required to work some weekends, some Sundays, and how do you reconcile the two? Well, I reconcile that, you know, just as you have sometimes some things that have to supplant others, and again, going back to Matthew chapter 12, Jesus made the point. He said, if the donkey falls in the ditch on the Sabbath day, are you going to get it out? Well, yeah. But is that going to require work? Yeah. So sometimes I don't want to use the word collision, but that's kind of what it appears, where you have a law here and a law here, and you say, okay, these two, we cannot exactly mesh them together because of the circumstances. You know, we recognize that this is true and recognize that this is true, but because they are at odds, one is going to have to be the one that we choose to follow and the other not. So applying that to the doctor illustration, I would argue if a person came to me and said, well, I'm in this profession, it does require me to work, this is not something that I want to do, then yes, you go ahead and you work the shift, and if you are able then to move things around at a later time, wanting to fulfill your commitment to God, you do that.
Paul said, be careful when you're judging people. A person is judging another person,
sure.
flesh. Be careful, because that's not solid ground to walk
on. That is true. In the case, and that's why I try to lay out the situation with the 80 hours. I mean, here it's pretty clear that the guy wants to work double what he needs to make things work. All right, George, back to you.
I think you hit on everything I was going to say. I mean,
okay.
We get Christ confronted for doing good works, performing miracles on the Sabbath, and he drew the comparison directly to David taking his troops.
Yeah.
Into the tabernacle to eat the showbread because it was necessary to provide for their physical survival. You know, if we're talking about a job that there's the difference between putting food on your table or not, well, look, the Sabbath was meant for man, not man for the Sabbath. Obviously, as Brad, as you said, that's not a situation you want to remain in any longer than possible. And should the opportunity come up and take a different shift or a different job, that will free up your Sundays, well, then you do it.
Yeah, and that's not situation ethics. That's just a higher law sometimes, where you have the obligation here versus there. All right, Tim?
Jesus was the most compassionate person that we will ever know of. And yet the scriptures say that we should emulate him and follow him and try to be like him as much as possible with us. So then, every single judgment that we make especially concerning others, needs to be tempered with compassion.
That's true.
We need to look at the circumstance and put ourselves in that person's shoes and say, how would I feel if they were judging me?
Well, it's the beam and the mote thing. It's very easy to see the speck in the other guy's eye where you don't see the big problem that you have in your life. All right, I'm just going to go from front to back because you're all three about the same. All right, Stan, Gary, and then Don. And then I want to go back to this illustration thing and look at it from a different vantage point.
The Bible doesn't tell us not to judge. It says to judge righteously.
Yeah.
So I think that means a godly judgment, and it means to use every bit of knowledge that you've got in order to make a good judgment. But we are human beings. We will make a mistake. So, unfortunately, what happens is you make 100 good judgments, and the 101st one is going to nail you, because that's the one everybody's going to latch on to.
But look at the police officer. Yeah. You know, 26 years, and she's put in a situation, and based on the reports, she's thinking, I got to go for a taser, one shot from a weapon, and a guy dies. So you're right, it's the 101st decision, and sometimes that has huge consequences. Gary?
Are you talking about the possibility of having to disfellowship someone? You are looking at what they're doing, but you're also thinking about how that could affect the rest. If the whole congregation believes, because of what they see, that the elders are in agreement with someone purposefully missing services that doesn't have to, then that's going to... that has the possibility of leading others astray.
A little leaven leavens a whole lump.
Yeah. And then kind of going back to what Betty was saying about you've disfellowshipped yourself. If they're not coming, they're not coming. But what if this person also happens to be a really good friend to everybody here, and on Friday nights he has game night at his house after work, and people always from the congregation always go there? Should they continue to do that? Or if the elders say, let's not do that for a while and see if he comes around, is that disfellowshipping? Or then, would you have to do a formal disfellowship?
You see, this is where the rubber meets the road. I mean, it's one thing to say, all right, don't live after the flesh and live after the spirit. All that's good. But that's really academic until you start trying to plug in some things, and we're probably going to go a little further than we normally would with this, but it's really important. And this is, like I say, the practical part of this. Don, to you, and then maybe Carol, I think I saw your hand flash.
Just one comment. Like Jesus saw people, he knew the innermost thoughts.
Correct.
We can't do that. So that's why we have to be very careful when we walk through this real thin ice. Make sure we are all solid ice before we do things like this.
Yeah.
I don't mean that we're doing it here, but
right.
Everybody does.
Yeah. Going back and using the medical imagery for just a little bit, if you go to the doctor and the doctor sees something, if you have a logical, rational doctor, hopefully that physician would probe a little bit rather than just jump right up and say, all right, let's send you off to the operating suite. But we're going to try to, either feel or ask some questions or run some tests to make a determination to see if there truly is a problem here that needs to be addressed. And church-wise, it seems to me that's what Christians would want to do, especially for the people who are elders. Rather than every member should do that as well. Rather than jumping down somebody's throat, you can go and probe a little bit and say, I'm kind of thinking along these lines. It looks to me like this could be a problem. Maybe there's some things that I don't understand or know. But if it turns out that those questions do yield some information which points you in a bad direction, then as far as elders, then that's something that needs to be explored and dealt with. Carol?
Place or not.
Ideally, people would self-regulate.
Yeah.
And I'm going to tell you what I mean by that, but that doesn't always happen. When you think about, let's think about a young couple. They've got a couple kids, younger kids. And as you're looking at the family, you're thinking, let's just start with the dad. Dad is really not doing what he should with the kids. You know, dad works a full day. Dad's bringing home income to help the family, you know, stay together and meet the needs. But when dad comes home, I mean, he's tired. Maybe he's working in a factory, and I mean, he's put in hard hours. And all he wants to do is sit in front of the TV. Now, can you identify with dad a little bit? I mean, you spent 8 or 10 hours out there, and maybe it's hot. You're working outside in 100-degree weather, or maybe it's cold. And maybe the work is back-breaking, and you come home, and you are just exhausted. You don't want to spend time with Johnny and Susie. You know, the idea of, you know, trying to sit down and have a Bible lesson with them, I mean, mentally taxing, you are just wiped out. So, as a Christian, what do you do? Do you say that that guy is minding the things of the Spirit? Or do you say he's fleshly minded?
Well, watching TV is going to make you more tired and more depressed than working all day.
All right. Okay, that's a mom's perspective. I'm just going to get a little bit more input here before I put my foot in it. All right, Gary, do you want to come forward?
I've got a dad's perspective, and I was a mail carrier for 4 years, so I can speak from experience with this. Luckily, my Johnny and Susie were okay with me sitting on the floor in front of the couch, and we played there. So I was sitting. I was able to rest as well as be a father. Now, was I up making the dinner and doing all that kind of stuff right as soon as I got home? No, but I was still being active. So if there's a will, there's a way. There's a way you can take care of that. And as far as working on the Sundays, you know, I chose to work for the post. Well, I didn't, in a way I chose, but I lost my job, and so I needed a job. And working for the post office was the first thing that came around and seemed to be the best. And I had to work Sundays for the first 2 years on occasion. And so I did miss services in the morning and sometimes in the evening because I was required to. Once I established a practice, they knew my rapport, that I was a good employee, I was able to adjust my Sunday schedule so I could still come to worship in the morning and then go to work afterwards. So if that's a possibility, they should be trying for that. If it's not a possibility, then yeah, you should maybe be looking for something else. You probably should be looking for something else so you can meet your other responsibilities.
Okay. Anybody else want to jump in there? Well, I'm going to pick up where Gary left off, and that is, if you are mindful of what God wants from us, and that is, live this life to the best of your ability after the Spirit, not the flesh, we might need to make some adjustments. And that's kind of where I'm headed as far as the transition here. Teresa, since she's not here, I'll use her as an example and a good illustration. There were a number of years where she worked outside the house. And kind of her rule for our household was, when I leave work and I get home, leave me alone for a little while. I just kind of want, you know, maybe 30 minutes to decompress for a little bit. Now, I'm sure she didn't get that probably as often as she wanted. But every day for her, that was what she wanted. And it was like, if I can make that 30-minute transition between leaving work and kind of coming home and having a little time to myself, then I'm going to be in the frame of mind where, you know, I might, you know, switch to fixing a meal or, you know, family time or whatever needs to be done. And I think that's the right balance that people need to have. You can look at your life and say, I'm so tired or busy or whatever, but still, at the end of the day, this is what we want to try to do. Now, if you make that choice, like other choices, it's probably going to cost you some things. If you are going to try to live after the Spirit, it's probably going to be inconvenient, especially if you have smaller kids. You might be ill spoken of, sometimes by Christians, perhaps not, and you're certainly probably not going to be on the best terms with the world. But I would suggest to you this. In spite of the cost that is associated with living after the Spirit, if you want to live after the flesh, do you think the cost is going to be a lot higher? It's the old, you can pay now or you can pay later program. And if you want to live after the flesh and you die in that state, it's going to be the pay later program, and it's going to be an eternal payment. As we've already seen from Romans chapter 6 and even back in Romans chapter 7, Paul says that's going to cost you your eternal spirit. We think about the mind of the flesh, quote here, it represents the individual whose goals and energy, his very being, are devoted to satisfying the flesh. There are a lot of people who as they look at their life, well, they would say, well, that's not really me. I don't want to be religious. I don't want to be a Christian, but I'm not really living in that way. But ultimately, that's what it boils down to. The person who's trying to live after the Spirit, here's the person who tries to stay focused on God, focused on spiritual things, doesn't always get it right, but really wants to love and serve God. And God says that's possible. Again, it's not always easy. In the early years, there are things that will plague you. In the middle years, there are things that will plague you. And in the later years, there are things that will plague you. So if you think, wow, if I can just get through this stage of life, it's going to be so much easier. Well, easier from this perspective, perhaps, but more challenging now. And then that just continues to shift and change. Ray, we'll take you after Gary.
The pay now or pay later, a lot of times people see it that clearly. But if you're choosing to follow the flesh, there are plenty of paying nows that you deal with because you miss out on the benefits of the church and the church family. And if no one's had that, if you've never had that, you may not understand what you're missing out on, or that the extra problems that you're facing by choosing a worldly life instead of a Christian-centered life. But yeah, there are benefits to now. So saying if you're not good, then there's definitely the pay later, but there is some also paying now.
Yeah, and that's true. And people, I think, undervalue the church, or at least they don't see the full value. I think sometimes about the book that Hillary Clinton wrote some years back, It Takes a Village, in talking about child rearing. When you think about the Jewish people, it sort of took a village. They had, you're that community. And you think about a local congregation as well. For parents who are heavily involved with a local congregation, their kids get to spend time with all kinds of people, children and adults. And there is that good sense of community, and that's extremely helpful to parents. Sometimes one parent can run interference for another parent that is from this family to that family and so forth. But yes, many, many benefits.
In the Old Testament, when a man took a wife, he was exempt from going into the military.
For a year.
Or if he planted a vineyard, again, the same thing, for a year. And if you build a new house, the same thing for a year. That was a law that they had set up for a particular reason. And we can think about that same thing today when we're doing this.
Yeah, the mind needs to be focused. We hear people say, well, I just can't focus on the task. Or a person will say, my phone's ringing, somebody's at the door, and I'm trying to fix a computer, and the pot's boiling over on the stove, and they sort of throw up their hands in frustration. But for many tasks in life, we do need to be able to concentrate. The things that you mentioned, and when we think about the spiritual side of life, God says it requires some concentration. It's not a balancing act where you just throw this in here with a million other things, but really try to direct your mind and thoughts towards God and see life through that spiritual lens, so to speak. As you look at the end of verse 6, Paul talks about peace. He says the people who are living after the Spirit, the people who want to live that life for God, he says the blessing there is going to be, I'm sorry, is it the end of verse 6? I was looking at the end of verse 5. He says, but the mind of the Spirit is life and peace. Some people ask, well, what kind of peace is that? Is that spiritual peace, or is that going to be, is it literal or physical? I think that as you go back to 5 verse 1, where he was talking about spiritual blessings, the emphasis here is going to be on spiritual peace. You do find, I think, that Christians do enjoy a better sense of tranquility. They think God is in control and has control of all things. But one of the reasons, I think, to say that this is primarily spiritual peace is tied to the word life. Paul says life comes to the people who mind the Spirit. And if he's describing that in the physical realm, then again, it just doesn't make a lot of sense. But if you look at it as far as that spiritual peace, that seems to fit the bill as far as what he's talking about. Verse 7, it gives us some information as far as why fleshly people do not please God. He says the mind of the flesh, what is it? He said it is, all right, it's hostile. It's enmity with God. It's the very antithesis of God. It's the thing that God says, I don't like. It refuses to submit to the law of God. We see that today. When people, there's a law, and people resist that law, that's not looked upon favorably by people. And God sees sin in that same way. John talked about that a little bit in 1 John chapter 1 and verse 6. If we say that we're trying to do what's right, and we're not, we are a liar. And then to reinforce the point a little bit, getting down to verse 8, Paul said, they that are in the flesh, if you want to live that kind of life that we talked about, he said, what's true? You cannot please God. It's going to be impossible. One source said that life in the flesh can be lived by the cultured, educated, and refined, as well as the murderers, thieves, and harlots. Now, I like that quote, because I think it brings out the point very well. We, as we think about fleshly life, go back to what George and what Betty were talking about. When we say, they're unethical or they're immoral, we have our little definition of that, and it's sort of the top 10 sins. And we look at the other people in life who are not really involved with those kinds of things. I mean, they seem refined and cultured, and they're not out there doing things that we would necessarily object to. But God says they're after the things of the flesh. They're simply not interested in His way and His will. All right, if we're going to get rid of this mind of the flesh, how are we going to do it? Well, let's back up and ask a different question. Why is a person able to be charged with having a fleshly mind? Why can God make that charge and make it stick?
Because it doesn't have God in his heart.
Well, that's true, but I think if we back up, we can give an answer that's even a little earlier than that. You have a fleshly mind, God says. No, I don't. God says, yes, you do, and what's the proof? You have sinned. When you sin, what kind of mind do you have? You have crossed over from that state of innocence to the state of you now have a fleshly mind. Now somebody says, well, you know, I said a couple of bad words, or, I hit him when I probably shouldn't have. But sin, you know, that's enough. The first sin, that's enough to put us in that camp. And we can argue about degrees all day long. You might say, well, my fleshly mind is not as bad as his or hers or theirs. And maybe that indeed is true. But it's like, are you dirty? Well, yes, your level of dirt may be less than him or her, but still, you're dirty. So if that is how we get the fleshly mind, sin, how do we remove ourselves from it? How do we get rid of it? All right, we've got to be converted, and that is going to culminate in baptism. And then how do we stay away from that fleshly mind? Or how do we deal with the times where we have those lapses back into it? All right, we're reading, we're studying, we're praying. There's repentance, there's confession. Getting back on the right track, trying to live that Christian life so we're walking in the light, right?
Philippians 4:8 gives us a list of things.
Sure.
Think of these things, it says. And so it's a substitution. What we used to think about, think of these things instead.
Yeah. Out of the heart, the mouth speaks. Out of the heart, people act. And you see that. When there's goodness in the heart, it comes out. When there's evil in the heart, it also flows. Anything that you want to add or ask before we move down a little bit and look at verses 9 to 11? Gary, and then Tim.
It's kind of like you are who you hang out with. If you
yes.
have a child that's making a lot of bad decisions, you look at where they're spending their time and what they're thinking about. You put them around good people, and they're going to naturally gravitate towards that. Their mind's not going to naturally do sinful things. It's going to steer clear of that.
Garbage in, garbage out. Wasn't that the old computer slogan back in about the 90s? It's true. And it's true in a lot of different areas. Tim?
What I was thinking was similar to what Gary just said. You know, the Bible says a tree is known by its fruit. We're all trees.
Yes.
And the world sees what kind of fruit we produce, even when we don't think so. It's pretty hard to hide what you do and what you say and what you think, because your brain is always doing this. And other people are watching you even when you don't even realize it. So we just got to be aware of what we say, what we do in front of anybody. Children. I've read several places that children pick up what their parents say and what their parents do because their parents are the number one teacher they look to. And all you got to do is start paying attention to what kids say and what they do, and then you know what they're learning from home. And Sandy's finding that out with her job, because some of the kids, first grade through third grade, most of them are pretty good kids, but some of them are quite belligerent and say things that you would not believe a kid that young could say. They're learning it from home. Well, we're all in that category. So,
Don.
As Christians, we still fall into the flesh realm sometimes, right?
That's true.
We have an avenue of prayer to get out of it. As long as we acknowledge that we've fallen into the fleshly side.
Yeah. I think that's where we, you know, just as we would maybe check clothes or we would check some other things, sometimes people, for example, if you think about someone who's had maybe skin cancer, now I'm no expert on that, but I'm thinking that people who have maybe live down south in Florida, and I bring this up because you've spent a little time down in Florida, but if people have skin cancer, I think that they probably do a pretty good job, especially down south, of checking their skin. You know, let's just kind of see if we have some spots show up and we need to get that looked at by the doc. Well, spiritually, that's what we should be checking for. Cancer spots, can we say. Maybe that's not the best way to describe it, but you know, we're looking for those things. I remember the Hebrew writer, he talks about the root of bitterness. That's a good illustration. We're looking for those roots. Some of us have had places out in the yard where a little tree starts, and when it's just a little sprout, it doesn't take very much to knock it out. But if you let that sprout grow up for a few years, all of a sudden it's now, I'm not going to be able to pull it out with two hands. I'm going to have to go get the shovel or the spade and do some serious digging to get that out. And that's what the devil is able to do a lot of times with sin. It's just like that little seed that gets in a crack, and before long it has a really, really good start in life. Stan?
Well, if you walk in the light as he is in the light, okay, I think tend to take that as being you've walked into this aura with no instructions or whatever, but Satan is not going to allow that. You're walking towards Christ, you're trying to do everything he's trying to do, you're walking in the light, but Satan's going to throw a tree or a wall or a rock or whatever, and if you're not careful, you're going to walk through that shadow. That's what we are as human beings. Hopefully, as life goes on, those get to be fewer and fewer and fewer. But walking in the light does not say that you're not going to have a problem now.
Yeah, but I think you see that with Jesus, not that he sinned, but you see that with Jesus and the devil. You know, he's there trying to do the will of God, and the devil just keeps throwing stuff against the wall, so to speak, thinking, all right, that fiery dart failed, so I've got three or four more here. And he does a very, very good job at that. Betty?
Yeah,